did it.
It takes a PhD, preferably a PhD in a different field. Kenneth Brick calls that perspective by incongruity. It's a great, an intense pleasure for me to introduce Diane, because, originally because that first reading of hers 10 years ago absolutely rocked me. She grew up in Southern California and graduated from UC Berkeley in 1960. And her poems have appeared in many anthologies, in Leroy Jones's anthology called Four Young Lady Poets, and more recently in A Controversy of Poets and in the Follett Young American Poets, and in a Random House selection, American Literary Anthology. And her work has also appeared in The Nation and The New Yorker and other magazines and quarterlies. During the past couple of years, she's read at the Guggenheim in New York under the sponsorship of the Academy of American Poets, and at the Poetry Center in New York, and Brooklyn, and Bard, and Amherst, and Brown, and Antioch, and other campuses. She's published 7 books of poems, the most recent of which is this, which you must immediately buy. It came out last year, published by Doubleday, and it's called Inside the Blood Factory. 3 more titles are forthcoming this year. They are Greed, Parts 3 and 4, published by Black Sparrow Press, Some Poems for the Buddhas, and The Moon Has a Complicated Geography.
Some Poems for the Buddha's Birthday.
Oh, this is a misprint. Some Poems for the Buddha's Birthday. Critics talk about Diane's originality and magical polish and her imagery, which shows a surreal influence. Although she uses surreal techniques, the purpose of the surrealism is itself not surreal. That is, I have a theory about poetry which we've just been discussing, which is that all poets are aphasic. Aphasia is the loss of speech. I discovered this one day by taking down off a shelf from a colleague's shelf a book on speech therapy. And there appeared in this book some examples of the speech of aphasics, of people who have generally lost the power of speech. And they talk in metaphor because they can't remember the word. They can't recover the word, so they invent words. And they speak in refrains, because once they found a way to say something, they say it more than once. I notice Diane says in one poem, I dream to offset my empty brain, which seems to me a sure mark of aphasia. She also says, which is perhaps more serious, love sits at the root of my tongue. It's at the root, and the effort is to bring it forth. For me, she is a profound, her work is a profound demonstration of the idea that poetry seeks not to communicate, but to achieve communion, and it hopes to achieve communion by finding its own center and expressing that center as directly and as vividly as possible. It's a great pleasure to give you Diane Wachowski.
I really do write poetry to communicate. It's because I can't talk to people. Or at least I couldn't when I started writing poetry. However, there are lots of ways to achieve communication. And I'd like to read a poem about some of the alternatives when you're presented with how impossible it is. This is called Rescue Poem. When he diagnosed my case, it left me with little hope. You have an invisible telephone booth around you, he said. It is the glass-hard cardamom whispers cannot penetrate, the glass of cut-out tongues and spider tracks, of the turn of a bolt one thread, and of the distance one hammer blow drives a nail, the space of a snake's forehead and the diamond ladder of a window washer, a shadow foot between the real foot and the ground. He smiles at my disease, says he would like to put his arms around me, but cannot reach around the whole invisible telephone booth. We walk through the night trailing lizards. Our heads are filled with fat, wet moss. Black camels walk around and through our eyes stamping on the city streets. We thread needles with our thin bones and sew streets together, trying to hold them in finger pockets. I cannot get near you, he says, that telephone booth being in the way. In the way, really, was the dial tone. The sound of ruby acorns pelting a roof of elbows. Busy, busy. The help signal gone crazy, reaching to years of hurricane weather. Here are the tools to chop down an invisible telephone booth. An apple inside the ear. A bucket of blood. A hammer made out of beetle tongues. A saw made from parts of the cheek. Teeth chipped out of the navel. Diamond breasts and a silver penis. Well, you came with strange luggage, a man from your own trust company, a bag full of incredible instruments. You looked at the doctor and said, I'm a specialist. Is she the one with the invisible telephone booth? She the one nobody can get near? She the one who stands naked inside it making long-distance calls for help and has linemen out every day wrecking their instruments on this invisible glass? Yes. You had a bag with apples rolling inside your ears, shaking their seeds into eustachian tubes and down alimentary canals. Buckets of blood were capped with silver fish skins and sloshed inside the black bag carrying hundreds of small initials. Your hammer of cricket tongues tapped itself to sleep, waiting for the big job. The saw made of all the soft parts of a cheek sharpened itself against eyebrows. Teeth chipped out of the navel were ready to bite. And diamond breasts with hard nipples rubbed against the silver penis, causing the fish eyes to glow. You set to work at once on the telephone booth. Need I say the obvious? That you found the door? That no one had tried the obvious? Need I say more? An obvious solution to an obvious problem. Come in. Put in your silver nickel, your pennies, quarters, dimes. Come inside these invisible walls. Join me on the silver, wiry inside. I write a lot of poems about the problems of being an individual in the kind of society that we live in. And one of our problems is trying in some way to deal with the cultural roles that have been foisted upon us due to the needs that society had maybe 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago that aren't necessarily society's needs anymore, but we're still stuck with the same kinds of roles. And this is particularly true of playing our roles as men or women in this society. And traditionally the man is supposed to be the weak or the strong. Yeah, <let's do> All right. I don't think I'll say anymore. This is called Follow That Stagecoach. The sense of disguise is a rattlesnake, and it's easy to wake up and find it curled in your shoe. Past Ghost Junction and Cody's Rock, the same stagecoach rattles day after day, long days and short days, carrying the same passengers. They keep away from you. Your six-shooter wanders into hand, disguised, yes, heavily disguised, as the homosexual sheriff bringing law and order to the West. Oh, but the ladies who ride that stagecoach want you to make love to them, but you never take off your shoes, for fear you'll wake up only to find a rattlesnake curled up in one of them. Sometimes you ride the stagecoach in another disguise. You are in a black rubber skin-diving suit, with your wet feet leaving prints like exotic fish on my forehead. Under my hair is a brain with too many memory cells clicking off your name, trying to ascertain your sex. I am swimming in Dry Gulch Hollow, thinking of Sheriff Stanley, who did love me, but left to start the Pony Express. His star I wear pinned to my black rubber skin diving suit, keeping clear of the 87 rattlesnakes swimming down the river. Oh, yes, I catch this stagecoach. You were on it, Mr. Sheriff. I would like to be angry that we're not swimming in the same body of water with everybody's body of water suggesting so many more. The Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian, Arctic, Antarctic. So many oceans about, not to mention the rivers, lakes, ponds, etc. Shall we go skin diving, I ask you? But it is clear I want to explore different areas. My own black rubber suit showing clearly I am a woman. Why did I find you? Black Aberdeen might walk in the ocean or Snowfoot stroll in coral reefs, but I am looking for the most beautiful fish, one that will shimmer his scales at me and feed me special algae, one with spiny teeth or soft train whistles, shiny with tamarind seeds, metaphysical with telephone books. Found you writing your poems on my brain with a diving fork and blood covering my suit with the words. Found you trapped in Dry Gulch Hollow, settling for trout. Found you and wanted to have you. Willing to lock you in my jail with a big iron key. Wanted to say, look, I found him. Give me the reward. I found him and he'll take me away to his territory. I'm not afraid of rattlesnakes. They sleep with me at night, curled around my warm neck. We exchange poisons. Oh, Mr. Sheriff, with sand on your eyes, with coyotes running out of your shoulders, with scorpions in your fingers, with overhand knots and loop knots and granny knots and reef knots and bowline knots and trefoil knots and a double bow knot tying your lips together and white and purple flowers on short stems. Yes, yes, yes. I cannot deal with the dichotomies. Would like to spend the day, river day and night day, day of piranhas and day of old lemon seeds, wearing your black rubber suit and swimming the ocean. No, it's that western body of water, Dry Gulch Hollow, that I see you in, and gives me a false sense of your movements. Sheriff Day, the sense of disguise is a rattlesnake. The danger is one I would welcome, living here in this rough country as I do, building my own house. My own disguises change so often. Which one can I wear that will not frighten you, though you are a tough western sheriff who obviously doesn't frighten easily, knowing you can swim quickly away in that rubber suit? What are you looking for? I'll show you a cemetery where you could find a tombstone saying, here lies the homosexual sheriff of Dry Gulch County. I didn't make this offer to the previous sheriff. Oh, yes, you are putting on your skin diving suit very fast, running to the ocean and slipping away from this girl who carries a loaded gun all the time and keeps company with rattlesnakes and goes diving only for the most beautiful fish. Mr. Sheriff Day, she writes you this poem from her dusty house. Walking naked is her most frequent disguise. It disarms everyone. The world by now is confused with all the costumes. The world by now takes her up and tries to make her wear the right disguises. She says, no, 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 I will go where I want to, when I want to, so I'll write you a love poem if I want to. I'm a Westerner and not afraid of my shadow. I think I'll read some George Washington poems. I've been writing George Washington poems for about 6 years or so now, and I think I chose George Washington because he is so typical of everything that we are in this country. He's really kind of awful and terrible, and at the same time, he sentimentally stands for all the good things that we would like to be, like honest and hardworking and noble and in favor of liberty and freedom and that stuff. He was a failure in an awful lot of things, and I think that makes him typically American, too. One of the things that he was a failure at was gardening. I read an article a few years ago in the Times called George Washington the Home Gardener, which they described all these plants that he tried to import from Europe and which died, of course, in Virginia. And I felt great sympathy. Kinship with them. This is called Cestina from the Home Gardener. These dried out paintbrushes which fell from my lips have been removed with your departure. They are such minute losses compared with the light bulb gone from my brain, the sections of chicken wire from my liver, the precise silver hammers in my ankles which delicately banged and pointed magnetically to you. Love has become unfamiliar, and plenty of time to tend the paintbrushes now. Once unfamiliar with my processes, once removed from that sizzling sun, the ego to burn my poet shadow to the wall, I pointed, I suppose, only to your own losses, which made you hate that 200-pound fish called marriage. Precisely, I hate my life, hate its freedom, hate the sections of fence stripped away, hate the time for endless painting, hate the sections of my darkened brain that wait for children to snap on the light, the unfamiliar corridors of my heart with strangers running in them, shouting, the precise incisions in my hip to extract an image, a dripping pickaxe or palm tree removed. And each day my paintbrushes get softer and cleaner, better tools, and losses cease to mean loss. Beauty to each eye, differently pointed. I admire sign painters and carpenters. I like that black hand pointed up a driveway whispering to me, the Washingtons live in those sections. And I explain autobiographically that George Washington is sympathetic to my losses. His face or name is everywhere. No one is unfamiliar with the American dollar, and since you've been removed from my life, I can think of nothing else. A precise replacement for love can't be found, but art and money are precisely for distraction. The stars popping out of my blood are pointed nowhere. I have removed my ankles so that I cannot travel. There are sections of my brain growing teeth, and unfamiliar hands tie strings through my eyes. But there are losses of the spirit, like vanished bicycle tires, and losses of the body, like the whole bike. Every precise bearing, spoke, gear, even the unfamiliar handbrakes, vanished. I have pointed myself in every direction, tried sections of every map. It's no use. The real body has been removed. Removed by the ice tongs. If a puddle remains, what losses can those sections of glacier be? Perhaps a precise count of drops will substitute the pointed mountain, far away, unfamiliar. George Washington also grew hemp plants. He had a large hemp crop, which he harvested, I guess, to make ropes out of. And this poem is called George Washington Writes Home About Harvesting His Hemp. I won't take a lot of shit in the name of love, not smoking it or eating it or shoveling it for you. You write a letter to Martha telling her how much you miss her, sitting at home, tied as a cable, managing your house. How you long to be there when the plants are harvested, the special crops you spent long hours reading the seed catalog about. Makes especially fine, thick, resinous fibers, said the book. So juicy at harvest time, you smell the medicine in the air. And so you make special plans to be there when the hemp is harvested. Your dreams take the form of women lying down, taking off their clothes on American flags, serving you in the name of your country, the soft aroma of virgin, ya hemp, curling around your nose like a cat rubbing at the cook's legs while she's making dinner. My first statement is true about you and me. The plants are ready to be harvested, the hemp sticky with brown dust as a caterpillar, and you, nostalgic, away from your plantation, coming in letters to remind us of your deep commitments there. But I'll let all that hemp die. The ropes it will make mean nothing to me but nooses. I will not take any more shit in the name of love, not smoke it or eat it or clean it up for you. This one is called Black Uncle Sam and Poor Old Fay Me. I've always been fascinated by the idea that blacks in this country who follow the wishes of the white power structure are called Uncle Toms, and that the totem for our country is Uncle Sam, and I've always wondered if there might be some analogy between the two. If maybe Uncle Sam weren't really black in secret. Black Uncle Sam and Poor Old Fay Me. My life rides past on a bicycle. My life is an eagle splashing in the bird bath. My life is an American eagle with his wings clipped, riding a bicycle. The story of my life, I am in love with the eagle who's flown away with a rabbit dripping. George Washington takes notes on my life, writing them in rabbit blood. Somehow the bicycle is an encumbrance. Uncle Sam enters. By this time, my life is a map of the United States. By this time, I have no sex, am nothing but a piece of paper with a few poems written on it. By this time, I am in love with Uncle Sam, but have lost all sense of identity. By this time, I am hysterical with love and hate and confusion, and my role comes through to serve me historically, that American patriot who writes of George Washington and Uncle Sam. So the feathers sift slowly to the ground as you touch my sleeve. Porches of snow sit on my lap. Closets of silk bolts unroll as I look for you. My voice is an old mountain hugging your name. But I will sing every verse of the Star-Spangled Banner in Latin to avoid talking to you. And will walk around the whole map to avoid being near you, you who are under my eyelid when I close it, who have stolen stars from my blood, who have shot at eagles and slipped them into your mouth, who have frightened me, yes, Uncle Sam, with your taxes, and have threatened me with a glittery jail, my feelings, the glinting bayonet, a nation at war. People who don't write poetry almost always ask this question. How come you poets write about such depressing things? Right? I have a quick answer to that if I can find it. You see a bag that says British Eagle? This is called With Words. Poems come from incomplete knowledge, from the sense of seeing an unfinished steel bridge that you'd like to walk across, your imaginary footprints floating like pieces of paper where the metal ends on the cold water far below, or the moon disappearing behind a cloud just when you could almost see the face of the man standing next to you in the olive trees. And consequently, I write about those whose hands I've touched once, trying to remember which fingers had the rings on them, speculating from a few words what the dialogue of a lifetime could have been, making the facts up out of the clouds of breath we release on a winter night. How can I then make a poem for you, whose skillful hands could make expert blueprints of all my bones? There is no need for a bridge between us. We sleep on the same side of the bed. Your mustache, inherited from some stealthy Cossack who kissed your great-great-great-grandmother and slid his icy cock between her warm legs one night, is no mystery to me. I can relive its history, drawing lines all over my body. I have no questions either about your powerful legs, arms, back, or the quick mind which leads the body around on a leash. Forgive me, then, if the poems I write are about the fragments, the broken bridges and unlit fences in my life. For the poet, the poem is not the measure of his love. It is the measure of all he's lost or never seen, or what has no life unless he gives it life with words. It's true, isn't it? Well, it's true about the sad poems. I have an idiosyncrasy. I guess we all have a lot of idiosyncrasies. I have one that I have acknowledged for a number of years, and that is I can't stand men who wear rings on their little fingers. So imagine my distress when a poet whom I much admire, Gary Snyder, appeared wearing a ring on his little finger. I rushed home and wrote this poem. Ringless. I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger. A white peacock walking on the moon and splinters of silver dust his body. But the great man, George Washington, cracked in half in my living room one day, and I saw he was made of marble with black veins. It does not justify the ring to say someone gave it to you and the little finger is the only one it will fit. It does not justify to say Cocteau wore one and still made the man burst silently through the mirror. Many beautiful poems have been made with rings worn on the little finger. That isn't the point. Flaubert had jasper, Lorca had jade, Dante had amber, and Browning had carnelian. George Washington had solid gold. Even Kelly once wore a scarab there. But I am telling you, I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger. He may indeed run the world. That does not make him any better in my needlepoint eyes. Why is a story? There were heaps of fish lying, shimmering in the sun with red gashes still heaving and the mouths of medieval lovers. There were gold and green glass balls bobbing in their nets on the waves. There were black-eyed men with hair all over their bodies. There were black-skirted women baking bread, and there were gallons and gallons of red wine. A girl spilled one drop of hot wax on her lover's neck as she glanced at his white teeth and thick arms. There were red and silver snakes coiling around the legs of the dancers. There was hot sun, and there was no talk. How do I reconcile these images with our cool president, George Washington, walking the streets? Every bone in my body is ivory and has the word America carved on it, but my head takes me away from furniture and pewter to the sun tugging at my nipples and trying to squeeze under my toes. The sun appeared in the shape of a man, and he had a ring made of sun around his little finger. It will burn up your hand, I said. But he made motions in the air and passed by. The moon appeared in the shape of a Negro boy, and he had a ring made of dew around his little finger. You'll lose it, I said. But he touched my face, not losing a drop, and passed away. Then I saw Alexander Hamilton, whom I loved, and he had a ring on his little finger, but he wouldn't touch me. And Lorca had rings around both little fingers, and suddenly everyone I knew appeared, and they all had rings on their little fingers, and I was the only one in the world left without any rings on any of my fingers whatsoever. And worst of all, there was George Washington, walking down the Senate aisles with a ring on his little finger. Managing the world, managing my world. That's what I mean. You wear a ring on your little finger, and you manage my world, and I'm ringless, ringless. I cannot stand the man who wears a ring on his little finger, not even if it's you. In spite of the fact that Doubleday is my regular publisher these days, I wish to maintain my loyalty with all the underground presses in the world, since they are the real publishers of poetry and the places where poetry is really read. And for that reason, I continue to publish books with small presses, and I'll publish a couple of books with Black Sparrow Press this year, one being called The Magellanic Clouds, and I'd like to read the title poem from that right now. The Magellanic Clouds for Eleanor, who likes to see her name in print. The Magellanic Clouds, for any of you who haven't taken Astronomy 1 or been to the southern hemispheres of this world, are some cloudy areas in the sky that look sort of like constellations, but probably are another galaxy. And they were first named by Magellan when he was sailing those waters and saw them. The Magellanic Clouds. The photographic plate is blurred. That blurry area is where you laughed and breathed on the plate. Lizard-skinned prickly pears roll out of your mouth. A purple bird twists your tongue with his beak, and crazy cactus leaves of love pin you luckily to one man. You have a mouthful of stars when you laugh, and you fall over the Milky Way at your feet. Next door, the Magellanic Clouds swirl and try to force themselves into your paintings. But you are too happy painting little hearts and big hearts and sticking them all over your husband, who is a river washing silver fish over you in the dark. Look carefully. My scream makes a silver line on the graph. The photographic plate is blurred. That blurry area is the Magellanic Clouds from another galaxy. Inside me swirls something like the Magellanic Clouds. All the animals I ride are found in the Magellanic Clouds. My life is destined to be a cloud, galaxies, light years removed. The dust storm on the desert, the fog over the river, a handful of dust with tiny shell fragments, a gold outline against the sky. How can I explain it to you and all the succulent women I know? Wives, mothers, loved, protected by men they love, having the shoulder to curl their heads into at night. How can I explain to myself this dust cloud that is my life? I talk in my sleep just as I talk when I'm awake. No one listens to me but strangers. Once, a blue vein of electricity came to me in the Magellanic Clouds and said there is a price on everyone's life. Uncurling my ears like new leaves, I looked at my world, my scarred body, my missing children, separation from the men who spoke my language. The price is to walk alone up the stairs, alone every night with your candle, and alone down the stairs, alone every morning, with white footsteps and teacups of tears. In your daydreams, you must carry the bodies of your children wrapped in white and strapped to stiff boards. People will chase you and accuse you of murder. The children will sing in your ears and cut you with the sharp corners of their smiles. Your songs will be bled out of you every day as you are cut with different tools: razor blades, knives, scissors, grass, paper, glass. One day the words will come out of your elbows and one day out of your knees. Scars and holes and craters will cover you. When people look at you, they will run away. But words, the words you've bought, will creep out of holes like beautiful skeins of thread. Someday I will vanish in the Magellanic Clouds, but will wait in rooms to get inside of paintings. Even the electricity, the fire, tells me I will not have to spend all my time in the sky. Someday it will be my breath blurring the photographic plates, and the astronomers will say, "See that cloudy spot on the plate? We once thought it was the Magellanic Clouds, but they've moved further out into space. It's something new, another enormous cloud made of strange gases and foreign particles. It's something new, and we have no name for it yet. And I will breathe harder, will blow harder, will blur more of the plate, will pass through rooms and rooms and rooms of memories in the shape of apples, birds, iron wheels. The clouds, the clouds, the Magellanic Clouds, the clouds in my heart, the clouds I ride on, the clouds under my bed, the clouds of my life, the clouds always in the next room seeping under the door. I am a cloud, dust over the desert, fog over the waters, gases in the sky. Can there be any sadness once I am named?" This poem is called "I Can Taste Time on My Tongue Like Salt." I'm buried here, deep in this clock. Around me my fingers whirl, being pushed by 17 jewels. I am 17 years old, a three-pronged hole for each year, time threading like a swift green piece of cloth through the sewing machine teeth. Each year a new jewel balancing delicately in its slot, I have broken my teeth, hoping that time would run backward. But the clock is the only measurer, and time, by definition, slips on. You, tiptoeing by, tell someone to love me. Send this message out. Send for someone to sit and look at this clock all day. Let them meditate on me, being buried here with rubies gouging my skin. Let them fasten their eyes on the hour hand so steadily they see it move. Let them feel the minutes in their eyebrows. Let the hours slide off their shoulders like silk shawls. Let my time, my 17 years, slip into their fingertips to be pressed on glasses. I am smothering in here, dying inside this clock. Sometimes I swell up with love for the world. Sometimes I think I can taste time on my tongue like salt, and I lick the gears, saying, love is a lot of touching, but here, inside this clock, love is crowded. Is it my own arm I feel? The gear teeth scratching, the dust sifting into my ears. I yell, come and love me, but don't smother. I've been in this clock for 17 years, and time clings to me like smoke. Come and love me. Love is just a glimpse of sky without smoke. Touch me. Give me space to breathe. All I can hear now are clock sounds. Another one of my heroes is Beethoven. And I like Beethoven because he's so angry all the time. I really like Beethoven because I like his music. I like the idea of Beethoven. This poem is called In Gratitude to Beethoven. The full roses with all their petals like the wrinkles of laughter on your face as you bend to kiss someone are bursting on the bush, spotting my arm as I carry a bundle of them to my friends. They seem to have come out of my skin on this hot, fragrant night, and I imagine the inside of my body glowing, phosphorescent, with strange flower faces looking out from the duodenum or the soft liver, white as my belly, the eyes always disbelieving the ugly processes that make a living body. Here I am, admittedly, a strange combination of images, yet constantly myself. A funny series of animals, from the gray field mouse quietly stealing through the grain, caught by the silvery gopher snake sleekly sliding across the grass, caught and lifted, wriggling like a wild mussel trying to free itself by the fierce, open-eyed hawk, being bitten itself by the deceptively soft tiger who will eat strange meat and is shot by the man, the hunter, who kills for sport. Somewhere there is a consistency, perhaps the threat of destruction, making me a predator in every cycle except the first one, and I have traveled so far from my beginnings. No one loves me. That I can say with certainty, without fear of contradiction in 100 years, by the series of images passing, and of course I am always slipping through life alone, as I am tonight, feeling a special gratitude for Beethoven, who, in spite of all fashions, remains a companion, whose place no one can take permanently. His music has all the life you loving people I hate so much are trying to squeeze out of me. Yesterday I discovered I was a stingy person. Today that even my gratitudes come out of angers at others. Who would admit as much about himself, that he was such a failure at creating that ultimate human good, love? Let me say it publicly, as openly as I can, with no delicacy or tact. I am like the guerrilla fighter who must sleep with one eye open for attack. A knife or poison, a bamboo dart could come at any time. No one has tried to love me without trying to destroy me. There is no part of me that is not armored. There is no moment when I am not expecting attack. There is no one I trust. There is no love left in me that is not a wildflower growing at its own leisure with no cultivation period and no sense of order. One perhaps that only Beethoven, now a violin or harp or piano, could love. At times like now, I am filled with the anger of bitterness, a sense of having been betrayed, and then cling even more fervently to old Ludwig, whose sonatas I played for so many years, feeling the field mouse in me slipping out through the pores in my skin, running about the dusty grain field looking for food. Sometimes I see my life as a cancer, a growth with no purpose, one that got out of hand by some malfunctioning organ. At times, you who look at me with so much tenderness, you make me cry. Where are you when I need you? This is all literary invention, a way of talking when there is no life. Must it be the reality? No one has ever moved more than the surfaces, the images. Where is reverence for the dialogue, the process? One friend tells me in the supermarket that I'm a bourgeois housewife and won't speak to me for 3 hours after my mentioning a need for protein. Another tells me I'm a pushy little girl after a conversation in which there was no agreement. Another says I'm a bad philosopher, and another that I'm weak because I cling to a man who can destroy me. But most friends tell me nothing, are simply not there when I need them. It is their way of dealing with the proliferation of images. Beethoven, my gratitude for you knows no limitations. I keep looking for a man who will satisfactorily replace you in my life. That would seem to show no gratitude, no satisfaction. It is, in fact, only a music I have in my ears, a need for a similar richness. I'll read another Beethoven poem, which is from... You can sit over here if you want, unless you like the back of my head. I'm worried about being shot in the back. You'll understand why after I read this poem. This is going to be part of a collection of poems that I'm working on called the Motorcycle Betrayal Poems, about all the betrayals in my life, starting with George Washington. And this is called Love Letter Postmarked von Beethoven. I am too angry to sleep beside you, you big loud symphony who fell asleep drunk. I try to count sheep and instead find myself counting the times I would like to shoot you in the back, your large body with its mustaches that substitute for love, and its knowledge of motorcycle mechanics that substitutes for loving me. Why aren't you interested in my beautiful little engine? It needs a tune-up tonight. Dirty with the sludge of anger, resentment, and the pistons all sticky, the valves afraid of the lapping you might do, the way you would clean me out of your life. I count the times your shoulders writhe and you topple over, after I've shot you with my Thompson Contender, using the .38 caliber barrel, or else the one they recommend for shooting rattlesnakes. I shoot you each time in that wide, dumb back, insensitive to me, glad for the mild recoil of the gun that relieves a little of my repressed anger, each time I discharge a bullet into you. One for my father who deserted me and whom you masquerade as every night when you don't come home or even telephone to give me an idea of when to expect you. The anguish of expectation in one's life, the hours when the mind won't work, waiting for the sound of footsteps on the stairs, the key turning in the lock. Another bullet for my first lover, a boy of 18, but that was when I was 18, too, who betrayed me and would not marry me. You, too, betrayer, you who will not give me your name as even a token of affection. Another bullet, and of course, each time the heavy sound of your body falling over in heavy shoes, a lumber jacket, and a notebook in which you write down everything but reality. Another bullet for those men who said they loved me and followed other women into their silky bedrooms and kissed them behind curtains, who offered toasts to other women, making me feel ugly, undesirable. Anger, fury, the desire to cry or to shake you back to the way you used to love me, even wanted to. knowing that I have no recourse, that if I air my grievances, you'll only punish me more or tell me to leave. And yet knowing that silent grievances will erode my brain, make pieces of my ability to love fall off like fingers from a leprosied hand. And I shoot another bullet into your back, trying to get to sleep, only wanting you to touch me with some gesture of affection. This bullet for the bad husband who would drink late in bars and not take me with him, talking about sex, flirting with other women, who would come home without a friendly word and sleep celibate next to my hungry body. A bullet for the hypocrites, a bullet for my brother who could not love me without guilt, a bullet for the men who run my country without consulting me, a bullet for the man who says I am a fool to expect anyone to listen to me, a bullet for the man who wrote a love poem to me and a year later threw it out, saying it was a bad poem. If I were Beethoven, by now I'd have tried every dissonant chord. Were I a good marksman being paid to test this new Thompson contender, I'd have several dozen dead rattlers lying alongside this path already. Instead, I am ashamed of my anger at you, whom I love, whom I ask for so much more than you want to give. A string quartet would be too difficult right now. Let us have the first movement of the Moonlight Sonata. I will try counting the notes instead of sheep. I write a lot of poems using Egyptian imagery and sometimes references to Egyptian mythology. I suppose that's because I like the idea of the desert, which is a place where nothing should be able to exist, but a lot of things do. And I like the idea that in spite of everything, one can exist, and very beautifully so sometimes. This poem, which I'm going to read, make some references to the sun god, his power and strength. Again, this is a poem about the problems of dealing with a society in which often those powers of authority or those father figures or those masculine images that we look to for strength are really emasculated and not very strong at all. And what one laments in that situation. This is called The Ice Eagle. It was with resolution that she gave up the powerful teardrops in her eyes. That crystal, the Venus-soft lizard-eyed creature called woman, gazes through. Her philosopher's stone, the sweet glass that drops from the sky. Ancients in sacrifice cut off tears with knives. The 50-pound eagle carved out of ice, sitting in the silver punch bowl, turned her attention to physical details. Why am I saying her? It is I, undoubtedly I, the life, a dream work. Undoubtedly, the life has been confused with the movies, and I, Gloria Swanson, walking discontented, for all parties become that to me. I cannot walk through the rituals without my golden mask, alas, three dozen of them hang on my wall, the thick lips reminding me of what has been eaten and has not nourished. Physical details, the lawn that sloped down to the sea cliffs, the swallows building their nests in rafters, the stone house punctured with courts and patios, bougainvillea winding up its sides, raw old Spanish wood composing chests and high stiff chairs moved and touched into water-like smoothness. The gravel driveway balancing the cutaway heels of beautiful women, the men swimming through the night in dinner jackets like paper cups floating on the ocean. Yes, her eyes, again. Why do I say her? I must insist, it is I. My eyes are informed of silk and the obsidian minds of the rich. Here is a thick, glossy, black, smooth idea, sex and nothing else. The rich are born bored and look for purposes, causes, projects to keep them busy. The women make up wild malachite eyes, green with beautiful sleep, and restless knowledge of new plays, new dancers, new books, new jazz. They can wring their Egyptian eyes with coal and be aesthetes, and in veils walk down the rocky path to the sea, riding black tigers of Sartre and Camus and Ionesco, yards of chiffon trailing their heels, and they despair the men, they, I, we, all women when it gets past social class, despair the men who have only the moon in their milky, fluid fingers. Yes, they wait. For the sun god we wait to find him naked in a blaze of fire, and we are stuck with vulgar substitutes, the fashionable avant-garde dancer, the sensational beat poet, the jazz trumpeter, the Negro novelist, and Amun-Ra, Amun-Ra, our father. They are all glorious, sun-brilliant artists, but homosexuals fucking each other, riding on their own black panthers, wading into the iron waters. Again, the women must rest their bodies against each other and moan. It is not the mysteries that draw the men, but the fear of that great mystery, the veiled woman, Isis, mother, whom they fear to be greater than all else. And I am sick unto death, sick, I say. We live in a world where men have forgotten their offices, only taking the woman, like good debaters assigned to the positive side on whom rests the burden of proof, only taking her on the surface. She, I, we can peel off layer after layer where you have taken her, and yet find the bottom deep and tight and untouched and longing for the greater measure. She, no, it was I, walked with the moon in Pisces and felt the trout slipping down into the ocean. The carved ice eagle of that party was melting into the gin and strawberries. In its beak, someone had placed an American flag. I found it hard to believe myself in this slippery, unreal, man-made country. Look, look, I want to say, the eagle is a powerful bird. In your fear, all you can do is carve him out of ice, and that leaves only one alternative in this temperate climate. The ice eagle can do nothing but melt. This poem is also based on an image of an Egyptian sun god. This was an Egyptian sun god who was called Aton-Re, and he was pictured as a round disc with rays coming out of it, but at the end of each ray was a hand, and it's called Reaching Out with the Hands of the Sun. I always have a lot of rules for myself in writing poetry. Well, that's so that I can, being an old Berkeley rebel, have something to break when I... One of my rules always has been don't put epigraphs in front of your poems because you're obviously going to compare yourself to somebody who writes much better poetry than you ever will. And it's foolish to set up that comparison gratuitously for the reader. However, this year I seem to be possessed with the desire to put epigraphs in front of all of my poems, frequently from Yeats, which is devastating thing to do. And this poem has an epigraph from a poem by Yeats called Adam's Curse, which goes like this. And thereupon that beautiful, mild woman, for whose sake there's many a one, shall find out all heartache, on finding that her voice is sweet and low, replied, to be born woman is to know, although they do not talk of it at school, that we must labor to be beautiful. Reaching out with the hands of the sun. Aton-Re, the sun disk whose rays end in hands, shines above us in New York, California, Egypt, sometimes even Alaska. Walking across the desert, he puts his scorching hands over our eyes and turns vision into sounds. Waves, as the ocean, drawing the pupils away from rattlesnakes, and blurring the hawks that sail so unconcerned with heat above our heads. When we ride across the snow and shaggy trees of Alaska, the sun's many hands rub thick bearskins and tallow against the apples of our faces. when we float down the river without barks of gold or flutes or beautiful boys in the heavy linen sails. The sun's hands reach into the Nile and pull out a glimmering eel or a water lily, holding it against the banks, motioning for us to expect life anywhere, even though it's not at once seen. The hands coming from the rays of that disc hold oranges, dates, figs, nuts, all those sweetmeats that give a woman fat thighs and a puffy face. What am I to believe in this world? The whirling sun disc that speeds years away puts out such rays with hands attached to each that fling me one day against the rough edges of mountains, one day caress me, push me against the long mustaches I love. My face varies from plain to dignified, my figure from straight to plump, my eyes from bright to small and sad, my mouth always a straight line as if crossing a T. And I see the world change around me. Only one thing never changes. Men remember, love, cherish, beautiful women. As I've said, like April snow, like silk that rustles in a fragrant chest, like a machine dripping with oil and running smoothly. I am pooh-poohed every time I say it. A woman of your intelligence, etc., believing such a superficial thing. Only the foolish, the misguided, the men with no balls, or the ones that don't really matter, love a woman for her beauty, her physical self. But I know different. I've ruled. I've walked with the mask of a falcon, perhaps Horus, over my head. Walked everywhere, stiff and disguised. Walked in stone, watching the life around me, the loving and not loving, without sounds to interrupt or change history. I've watched and know that even the poets whose blood is most filled with sun's light and whose hands are wet coming out of the rays of the moon love beautiful women, writhe, turn, upset their lives, leave their good wives when one walks by. And we, with fat thighs or small breasts or thin, delicate hair, pale faces, small eyes, with only our elegant, small-wristed hands to defend us, trying to catch one of the hands on a ray from the sun, loving our men faithfully and with hope, surely we deserve something more than platitudes. We are the ones who know beauty is only skin deep. But we also know we would trade every ruby stuffing and jamming our wealthy, opulent hearts, would trade every silver whistle that alerts our brain, keeps us sensitive and graceful to the world, would trade every miracle inside our plain and ugly blood factories, these bodies that never serve us well, for some beauty they could recognize, that would make the men stop, turn their heads, twist their minds and lives around for us. For those of us who love them and who never stop, whose hands are always radiating out, ready to touch the men with fire, direct from the solar disk, who brood, are dark often, with hands that come from the unseen side of the moon. And in defense of beautiful women, I have to... this poem is in three parts, and each part has its own private epigraph, just to break all my rules as thoroughly as I can. It's called A Poet Recognizing the Echo of the Voice. The first part is called The Isolation of Beautiful Women, and its epigraph is a paraphrase from an interview that I saw with Artie Shaw on television. Artie Shaw is famous for having married all these beautiful women, and the guy who's running the show asked him, how were you able to get 10 of the world's most beautiful women to marry you? And he answered, I just asked them. You know, men all over the world dream about Lana Turner, desire her, want to be with her, but very, very few ever ask her to marry them. True. The Isolation of Beautiful Women. We are burning in our heads at night, bonfires of our own bodies. Persia reduces our heads to star sapphires and lapis lazuli. Silver threads itself into the lines of our throats and glitters every time we speak. Old alchemical riddles are solved in the dreams of men who marry other women and think of us. Anyone who sees us will hold our small hands like mirrors in which they see themselves and try to initial our arms with desperation. Everyone wants to come close to the cinnamon of our ears. Every man wants to explore our bodies and fill up our minds, riding their motorcycles along collapsing gray highways, sequestering their ambivalent hunting clothes between our legs, reminding themselves of their value by quoting not mining stock prices and ours. But men do not marry us, do not ask us to share their lives, do not survive the bonfires hot enough to melt steel, to alchemize rubies. We live the loneliness that men run after, and we, the precious rocks of the earth, are made harder, more fiery, more beautiful, more complex by all the pressing, the burying, the plundering. Even your desertions, your betrayals, your failure to understand and love us, your unwillingness to face the world as staunchly as we do, these things which ravage us cannot destroy our lives, though they often take our bodies. We are the earth. We wake up finding ourselves glinting in the dark after thousands of years of pressing. The second part has a two-line epigraph from Yeats's poem To a Young Beauty. I know what wages beauty gives, how hard a life her servant lives. Movement to establish my identity. A woman wakes up, finds herself glinting in the dark. The earth holds her as a precious rock in a mine. Her brain is a jumble of sediments, of mixed strata. All men are miners, willing to work hard and cover themselves with pit dirt, to dig out, to weigh, to possess. Mine is a place. Mine is a designation. A man says, "It is mine." But he hacks, chops apart the mine to discover, to plunder what's in it. Plunder, that is the word, plunder. A woman wakes up, finds herself scarred, but still glinting in the dark. And the third section, which is called Beauty, takes its epigraph from Yeats's poem for Anne Gregory, who is sitting around lamenting the fact that nobody loves her for herself, and they only love her for her beauty or what she looks like. And an old priest says to her, "Only God, my dear, could love you for yourself alone and not your yellow hair." Beauty. And if I cut off my long hair, if I stopped speaking, if I stopped dreaming for other people about parts of the car, stopped handing them tall, creamy, flowered silks and loosing the magnificent hawks to fly over in their direction, stopped exciting them with the possibilities of 1,000 crystals under the fingernail to look at while writing a letter, if I stopped crying for the salvation of the tea ceremony, stopped rushing in excitedly with a spiky bird of paradise, and never let them see how accurate my pistol shooting is, who would I be? Where is the real me I want them all to love? We are all the textures we wear. We frighten men with our steel. We fascinate them with our silk. We seduce them with our cinnamon. We rule them with our sensuous voices. We confuse them with our submissions. Is there anywhere a man who will not punish us for our beauty? He is the one we all search for, chanting names for exotic oceans of the moon. He is the one we all anticipate, pretending these small pedestrians jaywalking into our lives are he. He is the one we all anticipate. Beauty looks for its match, confuses the issue with a mystery that does not exist, the rock that cannot burn. We are burning in our heads at night, the incense of our histories, finding you have used our skulls for ashtrays. I think I'll end my meeting.